The following is a replay of a webinar hosted back on February 13th, 2024, titled Breaking Barriers, Lessons Learned from Developing New Medical Technologies. Guests on the webinar included Dr. Elise Jenkins, CTO and co-founder of Opto Biosystems, and Dr. Grayson Zuloff, CEO and co-founder of ResonantLink. The duo discussed how they've partnered to advance implantable neurotechnology and shared more about their respective journeys as startup founders. Enjoy the conversation. The Medical Alley podcast is brought to you by MentorMate. MentorMate empowers healthcare clients to deliver on their mission and transform the human experience through technology. For over 20 years, clients have trusted MentorMate to guide their vision, design innovative products, and build secure solutions while understanding the specific nuances of their industry. MentorMate's global team in the U.S., Eastern Europe, and Latin America helps clients in all sectors of healthcare transform their organizations, from Fortune 500 pharmaceutical companies and commercial payers to hospital systems, medical device manufacturers, and beyond. Learn more at mentormate.com/healthcare. Why don't we kick off today's webinar. The title of today's webinar, as you probably know if you signed up for it, is Breaking Barriers, Lessons Learned from Developing New Medical Devices and Technologies. My name is Tyler Mason. I'm the Digital Media Manager at Medical Alley. So I'd like to introduce our two panelists today, and they're going to introduce themselves a little bit more. But for this webinar, we're joined by Dr. Elise Jenkins. She is the CTO and co-founder of Opto Biosystems, which is an early stage venture-backed company developing tiny implants to access, understand, and treat unsolved biological challenges. And Dr. Grayson Zuloff, who is the CEO and co-founder of ResonantLink. And ResonantLink has developed wireless charging for neurostimulators, pumps, pacemakers, and other implantable medical devices. Grayson was on a webinar with us last year titled Wireless Power and Recharging for the Next Generation of Active Implantables. You can find that on the Medical Alley YouTube page if you are interested as well. So I guess without further ado, I'll turn it over to the two of them to give a little bit more in-depth look at who they are and who their companies are, and then we'll get started with the conversation here. So Elise, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, sure. So thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very excited to be here also with Grayson. This is really exciting. And I just wanted to say thank you for taking a time out of your day to listen into it, to what we're up to. I'm very excited to share. So just some background. So my name is Elise. I come from a very small city called the Gold Coast in Australia. Despite desperately wanting to be a medical doctor, I actually trained in electrical and electronic engineering. I moved to the UK about 7 years ago. I spent some time in industry. So I was working at Siemens for a number of years in product. I was doing product support and product management. I then took a step back, went back to academia to do my PhD at the University of Cambridge. That was under Professor George Meliaris, and that was in the bioelectronics lab. This is also where I met my co-founder, so Dr. Ben Woodington. And together we created Opto to develop very small neural implants to help us understand and treat cancer. We raised about $2.5 million over the last year or so, really to try and help us accelerate our product development and grow out our team and experience. So really trying to understand, you know, why does Opto exist? And really we exist out of frustration. So cancer is a disease that I'm sure impacts pretty much everyone who is listening in some way, shape or form. Glioblastoma is a really horrific form of brain cancer that has a really bad prognosis. So on average, these patients are surviving about 14 months from the point of diagnosis. And the standard of care has really not changed for over about 20 years, actually. And so when I learned about this during my PhD, I was really dissatisfied with the status quo. And so I challenged that much like the electrical nature, the rest of our brain, perhaps glioblastoma and these cancer cells are actually electrically active. And if that was the case, then maybe we could harness that electrical activity to help us understand how they evolve, how we monitor them. And maybe on top of that, we could look at how we could use an electrical input to try and treat them. And so I spent a number of years really trying to study these interactions, this electrical nature of these cells, understanding their behavior under different electrical stimulus. And at the same time, there was this emergence of this fantastic field called cancer neuroscience. And during that time, it really the research was really solidifying our understanding of how the nervous system is directly involved in the progression of cancer in a bi-directional manner. And so at that time, where I met my co-founder, Ben Woodington, he was actually in the same lab trying to develop very small microfabricated thin film electrodes that you could place on the spinal cord to help with pain management and spinal cord injury. And so sort of together, we combined our experiences of our PhD to really focus at developing a neurotechnology platform that we could try to target GBM or glioblastoma. So over the last year, we've come together to really develop with our team a very small, minimally invasive neural interface. And so this device has been used or is being developed to be very small so that it can fit within a current surgical procedure. So something that is already done during practice of removing a glioblastoma. We've developed it to fit inside a cranial window. So it's about 14 millimeters in size. With that, we have a very soft, thin film interface lead that comes out the bottom of the device, actually penetrates deep into the brain, into the target location. And that's patterned with a number of electrodes so that we can actually interface with that tissue. And then with the help of Resonant Link, we've really developed this device to be fully wirelessly packaged so that we can interface without having basically to have an interrogator to interface that device wirelessly and power that device. So together with that technology, we're really trying to develop a new paradigm in cancer treatment that modulates or targets the neuronal input into these cancers. At the same time, harnessing that electrical nature of these tumors to provide a real-time monitoring solution. And all of this can be done with an implant that a patient can go home and we can record this from the patient from the comfort of their home. And so I think one of the things that we're really excited about over the next year or next number of years that this will take to sort of develop is to really demonstrate that the device is safe in a preclinical setting. And we're doing that by engaging with our collaborators on a global scale and really hopeful by the idea of developing this sort of new era in cancer treatment that's really driven by innovation and collaboration with the hope to actually provide a new option for these patients who don't currently have one. That's a little bit of background about Opto and me. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Elise. And Grayson, we'll let you introduce a little bit more about yourself and Resonant Link.
Thanks, Elise. And yeah, Resonant Link really exists to enable new devices like Elise and the team are building. We were spun out of research at Dartmouth College and Stanford University here in the US in 2018 and have been building toward this vision of making the next generation of implantables rechargeable ever since we spun out of the university. So for many people on the call today, you know how we recharge batteries that are implanted inside the body right now. And the way that we recharge those is with surgery. Your battery runs out on a pacemaker. Most neurostimulators, ventricular assist devices, we're going to have a surgery basically just to recharge that battery. And Resonant Link exists to make this next generation as easy to recharge as we can be. So going from this invasive, inconvenient, and dangerous surgery to something as easy as holding up this hub outside your body for 20 minutes and using that to recharge the battery instead of an invasive surgery here. So our mission is to make all the implantable devices rechargeable in the next decade. And we're really proud to be working with partners like Elise and I think 27 others today to make that a reality. So the reason that we launched into medical devices and the reason that we love working with customers is because we can use our technology to make patients' lives better. And so compared to conventional wireless chargers, I think what really sets us apart, and we'll talk about this today, is our team that really digs in and creatively solves problems with our partners to get them to market in the fastest way with the highest performance and the lowest risk. But the foundation of what we can do is the technology platform. And part of that is that we have 5 to 10 times lower losses in our coils. Part of that is that we're really good at integrating wireless charging around the complicated things that we need inside the body. So around tissue, around metal, around electronics, batteries, titanium cans, all of that makes medical devices one of the hardest places to send wireless power to. And we've spent the last 5, 6 years figuring out how to still make it great to get power inside the body. We have great power electronics. And then, like Elise mentioned in her introduction, we can integrate data up to and over 100 kilobits per second into the wireless power link. And that allows our partners to have higher data throughput and lets them eliminate other communication techniques that are complicated to make work inside the body to outside the body there. So we have a very fast recharge time. We can do charge a battery in 21 minutes, and we're trying to make that the standard of care in the neurostimulator and CRM market. But really, we work quite broadly from the tiniest devices like Elise is building up to pumps and valves that are require 10 or 20 watts. So for our customers, really what we want to do, so we want to reduce recharge times from 2, 3, 4, 5 hours down to 20 minutes. We want to enable completely new devices like the one that Elise and the team at Opto are building. And then we also want to move primary cell devices to rechargeable for this next generation. So we work with 28 different OEMs. We can work all the way down to 1 milliwatt, up to 10, 20 watts and beyond if there are applications that require that. And we're really excited to share more today about how we like to work with partners and most importantly, how teams like Elise's can enable these completely new treatments that make patients' lives better. So with that, Tyler, thanks so much for having us today. And I think we can open it up to some questions from here.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the things I love about my job is getting to interact with smart people, and the two of you are doing some pretty wonderful things that are way beyond my pay grade, but so awesome to learn about that work, and I'm excited to learn more as we go here. I want to start off with a question for the two of you here. Both Opto Biosystems and ResonantLink's core technologies, as you kind of both alluded to, originated at universities. What advice do you have for those who are looking to commercialize their technology, who may be in a similar spot to where you two were, a number of years ago?
I'm happy to take this to start with. I think there are two sort of pieces of advice that I think would have been really useful to know before we started this journey. I think to start with really, really loving the problem or the solution that you are going to be creating. So if you're developing a new technology, you've really got to love it because, you know, these, especially in the medical device space, this is hard. It's going to be hard. And when it gets hard, you need that motivation to keep going and you've got to love it. So I'm very glad to love exactly what I'm doing. I think within that same realm, getting very comfortable with people not always liking your technology or solution or vision. I think that's a building your resilience. I think that's one part of that. I think second and probably more important is as engineers developing a lot of these technologies, it's very easy to want to develop the coolest, most exciting, most innovative technology, and definitely striving towards innovation. That is great, but really trying to understand what is the problem that you're trying to solve, what is the challenge that you're trying to solve, and for us, that's a really difficult disease in real patients. And so being very focused on understanding your problem, understanding the patient need, and developing to that need, and not over-engineering because something is cool. These are people, these are patients, and these are real diseases, and they need real innovation. So that's an easy one to slip when you're in the earliest phase. So I think trying to keep focused on that is something that would have been good right at the start for us to know.
And Grayson, how about you? Same question.
Yeah, just to build on what Elise said, I think knowing the problem you're solving for your customers, for your patients, for whoever's ultimately going to be using the product is the biggest shift coming out of academia. Hey, here's how we're going to publish this. Here's what the state of the art is. And that shift to being like, okay, what exactly problem are we solving for our customers or for our patients or for the end users of the product, I think is the most important shift to make. And it's a really hard one to transform. Like Elise said, it's about like how you're solving that problem, how you're getting that problem solved as quickly and as easily as possible, instead of building the most elegant, the most well-designed solution. So I think for us, we started with a great wireless charging technology and really looked around at where are the places that wireless charging would have the biggest impact on the world. And the reason we launched into medical devices was because it was the only place that we found where wireless charging could save lives. And then we've really built the company around that mission of serving our partners, who are our customers, in getting their devices to market as quickly as possible.
Awesome. Now, when we think about medical devices and developing new technologies, we know there are hurdles to overcome. I guess from both of you, for your experiences, what are some of the barriers to developing new medical devices and technologies? Maybe Grayson, we'll start with you on this one.
Yeah, for us, we really view it as you have an end indication, and there are a lot of different complicated parts of the system that need to come together. And Elise is the expert here, so I'm eager to hear what she has to say. But any of these systems is naturally going to be a complicated electromechanical system with software that probably interfaces with patients and clinicians. You've got firmware that's running the device, communicating data throughput, a lot of different electrical systems. And then at the end of the day, a clinician needs to be able to reliably and safely implant the device in a patient. And that means you have both a complicated user interface challenge, both on the software and for the clinician, and a big engineering challenge across all of these subsystems. So I think what ResonantLink's really trying to do is we're trying to take one of those subsystems off your mind. So for Elise, knowing, hey, we've got the lead interface, we need to make this as tiny as possible. We need to make sure the data throughput makes sense. We need to make sure the indication is working. And the thing that we're trying to help Elise with is, hey, we can take the wireless power piece off your plate and have a partner there that's singularly focused on developing that.
Yeah, I think to add to this, the number of technical barriers, or to go separately to the number of technical barriers, like just for developing a medical device in general, you have several barriers that you need to overcome, from regulatory, reimbursement strategies, ethics, market penetration, market size, all of these different things. And I think what they all kind of allude to is the length of time that it takes to actually conceive a medical device product and get it into a patient and get it into market is a really, really long time. And this is partly due to the medical practices is relatively conservative in accepting and adopting new technologies. And rightly so, like these technologies really should be demonstrated that they are safe and that they are efficacious in a clinical setting. So those things all take time, and they all are super valid. So I think one of the ways that we've been trying to accelerate our development, so that we know that it's going to take a long time, but how can we shorten it and get into market and help these patients sooner, is really by focusing on the interdisciplinary nature of the technology development that medical devices are. And so our core team, we kind of have experience from the robotics industry, medical devices, cancer biology, neuroscience, and clinical expertise. And so one of the core things, or one of the, our core focus right now, is to really build up on that clinical expertise and clinical input, so that we're making sure that the device, as it's translating, will actually be used and implanted by the people who are going to put it in. So if there is anyone on this call who are excited by what we're doing, or interested by what we're doing, and would like to chat more, I'd love to hear from you. So please do reach out. Clinicians, neurologists, neurosurgeons, anyone in the medical space. That's how we're going to get this technology to patients faster.
Awesome. And we've actually received quite a few questions already. So just to everyone who has already submitted a question, just know we will get to as many as we can. We're going to save some time for those in just a bit, but we want to kind of get through some of these other topics here first. I guess for the two of you again, what differentiates you and the work you're doing from companies out there who are doing maybe something similar? I guess, Elise, we can start with you this time.
Yeah, sure. I think there are several technology differentiators, so I'll end with that. But I'll start with really what our indication is. So our core focus right now is to developing minimally invasive neural interface to monitor and treat cancer. To our knowledge, we are the only people doing this in targeting the cancers in the manner that we are, which is targeting the nervous system. And so in the research setting, we've been doing a lot of development to try and understand in real time, in vivo, how these tumors are evolving. And so we've been monitoring that tumor and how it could be helpful for intervention strategies. So trying to understand how that would translate to the clinic. And what we've found from that is actually a lot of information of how we can actually target that on the input side. So we're really starting to trial now a lot earlier than we expected how we could actually treat using an electrical input. So that's how we differentiate definitely on the clinical side or on the indication side. From a technology point of view, again, there are several, I guess, differences in the technologies that are out there today. Nothing quite doing what we're doing, but several other minimally invasive neural interfaces. The BCI space is exploding right now, which is totally awesome. But to talk about those differentiators, our device is super small. As I said, we're sub 14 millimeter device sitting within a standard burr or 14 mil perforator procedure that's done classically in neurosurgical practice. Our device is compact. We use thin film metal polymer based electrode materials. This is great for conformability within the target tissue. Also allows us to expand our channel count to whatever we might need it to be. So we're trying to focus on what it needs to be, not what it possibly could be. We have been, as we're here today on this call, have been leveraging the expertise from ResonantLink and their technology to really get us down to a small size. So using that wireless power to power the device, we're actually batteryless. So this is, I think, one of the key differentiators as well. We don't require a battery. We only interrogate the device when we need to actually do any form of intervention or reporting. And the casing and the way that we manufacture the technology is actually done using optically transparent materials. This helps us with our optical communication modality. All of those kind of leverage the fact that we're MRI compatible, which is an absolute need for monitoring any cancer patient.
And Grayson, if you want to offer your two cents on that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we shared a little bit in the introductory slides on what makes ResonantLink different. I think our technology, we have this 5 to 10 times lower loss coil, and that basically allows us to do deeper implant depths, better alignment tolerance, smaller size, faster charging, and higher efficiency, all under those 2 degrees C FDA limits. And so really for us, it's the goal is enabling a better device for our partners, and everyone needs something a little bit different there. And then I think the second thing that really sets us apart is our team. We love diving in to deep, difficult wireless charging problems, and we can take all of the platforms that we've developed to date, all of our experience, and bring it to make that piece of the system work seamlessly. We've got 14 PhDs on the team. Our partners interact with them every day, every week for sure, as we're going to market. And it's really that trust that we build with our partners is what's at the foundation of everything we do.
I know, I imagine with the work that both of you are doing, the next couple of years are going to be pretty important for you. What excites you most, and what do you maybe see as your biggest challenge in the next 1 to 2 years? Elise, we'll start with you again.
Yeah, sure. So much excites me. I think at the moment, what has been really, really exciting is seeing sort of concepts and ideas from the very start, like the foundations when we started about a year and a half ago, actually seeing them become real devices, holding them in our hands. And I think a particular highlight for me has been, we work very closely with neurosurgeons over here in the UK, and actually getting them to handle it, practicing inserting that device, and seeing how it evolves and iterates, and how that would start to look like we're starting to see how that would look in clinical practice. And that's like really, really exciting. I think one of the, I mean, several challenges to come with any medical device translation. Our core focus is trying to develop a technology that is going to go to patients and is going to have a benefit. So the key challenges we see are essentially making sure that the device is safe, and safe in a long-term preclinical setting, and really validating that there is actually a useful benefit to the patient. So we're doing that in our in vivo settings in the preclinical models, making sure that there is a real benefit to the patient and we're not wasting all of this time engineering a device that's actually never going to get to the patient and have benefit. So those are really our big challenges. Unlocking those challenges, or sort of as we learn and develop on those challenges, that will give us the funds, fundraising at least, assistance so that we can really take that device to the clinical setting.
Grayson, what excites you most about the next couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we're doing this for patients, and our partners are the ones that enable that, people like Elise. So I think what we're really excited about is finding more people that are dreaming big, whether it's on completely new devices, completely new treatments for new or indications that haven't had a good one before, like what Opto is doing, or people that really want to join our mission to make this next generation of implants rechargeable for existing devices. And so I think that's what we're most excited about is just working with more and more great partners, making the patient experience with power and energy better and better. And then I think the big challenge there is continuing to build that power and energy ecosystem. We can do great charging, we can make that piece great, and we're starting to trend more and more into how can we help our partners on things like stimulation, like batteries, like geometry design, we spend a lot of time with already today. So we're really excited basically to just keep making power better for patients.
And so we had a question come in that kind of was part of what my next question was. So Gabriel asked, how did you both first connect to collaborate? And the question that maybe you can kind of wrap it into this is, what makes a good partnership and what should medical device makers consider when thinking about whether to bring in an external partner?
Yeah, Elise, you should definitely take this because I actually don't know how you guys found us.
Yeah, so I think Grayson kind of touched on it earlier in his introductory talk, but there are so many challenges that you're going to have when you're developing a medical device. And I think part of the reason that we chose to definitely one search for a partner on the external power was because it wasn't really that wasn't the part of the innovation that we were trying to expand on. We were not trying to innovate in that area. And so then when we went out to look for people that could help us on that, or whether we needed that core expertise in-house, we spoke to lots of different partners. And I actually remember the first time I came across ResonantLink actually on Google. So I found them there. But when I first spoke to Grayson and started hearing about what they had done, I mean, I'm an electrical engineer by nature. I was pretty excited to hear that there has been some innovation in the way that we actually make coils. So and like the way that you can stack them to make power more efficient. So I was very excited, one, to hear that there was innovations happening in the space, two, that they were specific to making these for medical devices, and their part of their realm was actually focused on medical devices. They had a lot of competence, and not only that, but I think one big part about making those decisions, especially in the early phase, is that these partnerships are going to be long, right? The journey to making a medical device, as we've said over and over, is a long journey, talking 10 years at least. This partnership is going to be a 10-year journey. So when you're considering that, the other part you want that we were trying to consider is like, can we actually interact with this team? Can we work with them? How do they like, what do they value? How does the company like operate? Are we going to get along? Are we going to have laughs on the calls? Are we going to be serious and actually develop the product? You know, there's lots of things that I think you have to consider in a long 10-year journey, and some of those were easily sort of found when I spoke with Grayson first and worked with their team on the opportunity study. It was a very obvious transition to go forward with them, not just for their offering, but for the general energy of the team, and expertise of the team. So, plus they educated us so much, and that's been amazing.
And Grayson, if you want to maybe touch on the partnership with Opto, but also just kind of more broadly, what do you think makes a good partnership between companies?
Yeah, I think to echo what Elise is saying, like for us, our goal is to care as much as our partners do. And we set that up with the team and how we approach the programs. And we also set that up financially with the deal structure that we do with our partners, where we don't make money until they make money and they're successful in market. And so I think, you know, we also partner, we're a partner as well. And like, I think at the end of the day, the most successful ones, like Elise is saying, are people where it's going to be a long-term partnership. It's not a one-off thing. Hey, here, let me drop this in your lap and wash my hands of it. Like, that's not how we approach it. And from the team that we set up with our partners, from the financials, from the culture and our values, we care. And that is, I think, really at the end of the day, all that we look for in partners. And then we try to bring that to the partners that we're helping develop their products with.
Excellent. We've got more questions in, and we'll get to those in just a minute. I've got one final one for the two of you before we get to the Q&A from the audience. For both Elise and Grayson, any final words of wisdom for the audience before we open it up to their questions?
I think the only thing I'd add to it is that if you're, you know, if you have a real challenge and you have a potential solution, share those solutions, share those ideas. I think there's maybe like a barrier for people to want to share their ideas and be creative about trying to innovate in a space that is very, very difficult and has so many challenges. So I just feel like share, be collaborative. There are people who want to solve the problems, and they can help you and reach out to people and get their expertise and help and just go for it, I think is my only comments.
I don't have anything to add to that. Let's get to the audience questions. I love that.
All right, well, we've got plenty to get to, as I said. So I'm gonna kind of pick and choose here. We might start off a little bit bigger picture. We've got some more kind of technical specific questions as well, but maybe start with a few that are a little more widely applicable here. Mark asks, how have you managed your regulatory and quality challenges? I guess if either of you want to take that one, or if both of you are welcome to answer that, whoever wants to go first.
With a lot of expertise. So I think one of our key hires early on was to bring in someone who has a lot of experience in actually regulating these devices in the FDA space, so on the US market side. So from especially from going to sort of lab-based device to medical device, we sort of really in the earliest phases really set out what are our user needs, what are our product requirements, and what would be our strategic route into market. So that's been one of the ways that we've been looking at trying to understand the regulatory space. One of the key things we've found there is whether one of the key questions I'm sure many companies have is whether to have their own quality system and do everything in-house, or whether to use certain manufacturing partners. And a lot of the work we've been doing so far has been looking at manufacturing partners who are already set up to do this space. They are already regulated under the relevant ISO standards. So trying not to reinvent the wheel in so many ways, like the partnership with Resonant Link, like partnering with manufacturing houses that have these established quality systems in place, and really just bringing in that expertise and those experienced people who know how to regulate these technologies, and know how to make sure that they're developed in the right way. Of course, there's a lot of preclinical work that needs to happen alongside all of that.
Grayson, anything you want to add to that?
We basically work with our partners to support their QMS systems and their regulatory approach. So we'll help prepare master files for regulatory submissions. We'll do the necessary testing on the charging piece, but it's really partner dependent on how they are approaching their regulatory and quality pathway.
Someone asked here, someone who's a PhD student asked, so kind of getting back to the roots of the two companies here, how did you go about founding your own startup from the ground up? While you're maybe in a previous job, this person's a PhD student, love to have their own startup, has an idea, but can't imagine what the next steps would be after graduation. So if you have tips for, how to kind of balance that, I'm sure it's a lot of work and a lot of, time. But if either of you have kind of from your experience what you'd want to share for on that would be great.
Yeah, I have lots of thoughts on this. When I was doing my PhD, I had absolutely no idea how to do a startup, right? How to even begin. So I think part of that journey was getting involved in an accelerator. So taking that idea and pitching it to an accelerator, getting very familiar with understanding how to pitch, how to make a pitch deck, what's a data room, like all of the things that you're going to need to do to fundraise for that journey. Also, understanding how to pitch your narrative, whether you've actually got a real solve that people need, is there a market requirement? These types of things that you really learn by going on those accelerators. And I think the other part to that would be having a co-founder, like finding someone to do the journey with you. It's I've seen both sides. I've seen people who do it on their own, and hats off to them to do it on their own. But doing that journey, being in the trenches with someone from day one, I would say it would be a good place to start as well.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a PhD is the best time to found a company. Don't tell my advisor, but it is like the time where you have, in some ways, the most freedom of time to pursue things that are interesting, and hopefully a kind of baseline salary from the PhD program. So I kind of sat down with my advisor and said, hey, Juan, like I'm looking at starting a company. Like, what would it look like for me to continue my research and do that? Some of the time. So you have kind of freedom, more freedom of time than most jobs. And you probably have something really differentiated that you're working on through your PhD. So I'd say take those two and give it a shot there.
Awesome. Got a few more kind of broader questions, and then we'll get into maybe some of the more technical stuff. Someone said that Elise, you'd made the comment about getting comfortable with people not liking your product or your idea. And wants to know, how did your VC presentations go? Happy faces or confused looks, or maybe both?
Yeah, I say this because it's not so much that people don't like your idea. I think when you're really doing something really new, there is always like a barrier that you have, or usually an education where you need to get someone familiar or get someone on board with at least the foundations of why you exist. So it's not always a case that they just don't like you. It's sometimes they don't like the idea because they don't understand it, or sometimes they just don't like it. So I think most of the time during our first fundraise, we've only done it once. We're about to do it again very soon. During the first fundraise, It was mostly positive. Like, people are pretty excited to hear that there's something new and potentially a new treatment paradigm down the line. So, like, people are usually pretty excited. We definitely get confused looks when we say like you're targeting the nervous system to treat cancer. They're like, what? And then you educate, and then you send them the literature, and you show them what you're doing, and people get actually really on board with that. So what I mean about getting comfortable with people not liking your ideas is that it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, and that's fine. You just got to go for the ones who really like what you're doing.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to go back to what Elise said earlier, it's like the financial partners, they're also a partner for the next 10 years. And so it's really about finding the fit with someone that you're going on this long, long road trip with, and there's going to be ups and downs, and it's about finding that 10-year partner there.
We'll maybe stick on this fundraising question train for just a minute here. Someone had a question about when raising your initial seed money, how did you determine how much was needed and what was your criteria? I guess for either of you, Grace, maybe if you have thoughts on that one first.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, funding strategy is like long-term company strategy piece. And then I think, most rounds, there's a clear milestone that you want to hit to get to the next phase, whatever that is. So I think in seed funding, often it's de-risking some of the core technology risk or some of the core market risk. And those were really where we were focused when we raised the seed round.
It's the same. You're setting a milestone, and the capital that you raise should at least allow you or enable you to reach that milestone, and some after that, so that you can also raise the follow-on funds.
This next one, maybe Grayson, for you. Someone asked as a follow-up to the partnership discussion, when an organization like ResonantLink provide the technology that could serve multiple early-stage R&D efforts, how do you balance desires for exclusivity by any individual developer you partner with versus the global value of broader dissemination of the medical innovation?
Yeah, so our approach is we never say no to our partners. We'll talk about any idea, and that includes exclusivity. And right now, we're fully non-exclusive because we want to make the next generation of implants rechargeable. And so exclusivity is something we consider very, very carefully, and we have not done it to date with partners, but it doesn't mean that it's something we won't talk about.
No, Elise, we've had a couple ones kind of directed for you. One that just came in. I said, could Elise talk more about the anticipated benefit to the patients to monitor or slow GBM progression? Is the thought to pair it with current treatments to evolve them based on unique patient responses?
Yeah, sure. So initially, when we started looking at this, we were looking at how essentially looking at the neural activity, or the activity that's present in the brain when you have a tumor, and how that was changing as a function of growth. So what we've been doing is trying to understand with that information what intervention could actually be used. And so in terms of where it would sit in the current standard of care for GBM, is normally you have a surgical resection where they debulk as much of the tumor as possible, and then they deliver chemotherapy and radiotherapy. During that resection, we would pl like our intention was to place that device and monitor the progression from to recurrence, basically, that recurrence is inevitable. And the idea being that we would be able to tell in real time when that tumor was actually becoming more aggressive and not responding to treatment. What we found so far with some of the discussions that we have with the oncologist, I think that was part of the question, some of the neuro-oncologists and neurosurgeons that we speak to, is the value of using this in lower grade tumors, where the intervention that they can actually make might have a bigger extension or benefit to the patient's life in terms of life extension by, for example, delaying radiotherapy or changing the chemotherapy. As we've been developing on this from the monitoring point of view, we've actually started to look at electrical stimulation for a treatment paradigm. So that kind of shifts, and we're still trying to understand exactly how that would fit in the current standard of care.
Someone asked, and this could be for either of you two. They said they might have missed this. How many clinical trials are you running? I don't know. I can't remember if we talk much about clinical trials, but if either of you want to touch on that.
We are not running any clinical trials because we are very, very early stage. So everything we're doing is preclinical. We do large animal studies to validate safety of the device in healthy models, and we use small rodent models for looking at cancer. So we have to basically miniaturize the device again to do this in rodents. So we do both at the same time.
Either of you, kind of going back to the starting your own company, what was that eureka moment that ultimately motivated you to start your company? This person said, I imagine most people are here because they have an interest, but there's a lot of activation energy that needed to make that leap.
Yeah, it's a fun question. I guess maybe I'm lacking inspiration in some way, but I feel like it's much less a eureka moment than a sum of many tiny moments and a lot of hard work. I think for us, we had this great wireless charging technology. We demonstrated it in a paper that it was 5 to 10 times better than other wireless charging technologies. But I think really like the closest thing to a eureka moment was starting to call on some of the biggest medical device OEMs and them saying, like, you need to come to our office tomorrow. We really need better recharging. And that's kind of when we started leaning in more and started learning more about what rechargeables or wireless power could do in medical devices. But it's the sum of many, many small moments, at least for us.
Yeah, I think similarly to what you've said, Grayson, for us, I think for me, it was more of a frustration than like a eureka moment. I've spent a number of years really trying to understand this disease and really trying to come up with a better solve, and just so dissatisfied. When I talk to clinicians, I've worked with many clinicians during my PhD and surgeons, and going to these surgeries and seeing what these patients are going through, and was just I just felt like that we had to try something new. So the eureka really came from frustration. And in terms of like what evidence did we see, or what really inspired that, I think was a combination of the work that I was doing in my PhD, and at the same time, this really emergent field of cancer neuroscience just solidifying that understanding that the nervous system is so inherently involved in cancer and in so many other diseases. And so it's like the opportune time is really right now for us to try something new and really try and target that, harness that nervous system input and see if we can make a difference for those patients. So that was our eureka.
One of the questions is asking about board of directors, and I don't know if either of your companies have boards at the moment. So maybe if not, we can kind of look forward, think about someone asked, what do you need most from a board of director member for your organization, and what is the best path to go about finding or retaining that board member? So if you don't have a board yet, maybe your thoughts on just kind of what you would look for or things to consider maybe.
Yeah, I think, and we have a board of directors, and you're looking for someone that's supplementing the company and moving it to that next stage. It's typically someone that's experienced, knows kind of the path that you're on from some unique perspective, and can be someone that holds the company accountable and kind of pulls the company into the next phase there.
Yeah, I don't think I have any additional input. Just looking for those types of advisors and that can help in scientific, commercial, medical, any of those spaces that will push you to move in a certain direction.
Another question just came in, and Grayson, I'll direct this one to you. What is the status of regulatory or FDA approval of implantable rechargeable batteries, especially regarding the safety, maybe concerns of overheating?
Yeah, so there are a number of implantable rechargeable batteries that are approved and on the market. There's a few different companies that supply them, but there is a broad range of devices. Probably the most adopted today is in spinal cord stimulation. About 40% of that market is rechargeable. So we're working with those off the shelf or customized, but already approved batteries. Bringing the recharging piece where needed. Elise's device, I think, is passive, so no implantable battery required. But for the partners that need it, we do use basically partner with those companies that have approved rechargeable batteries.
At least a couple of technical questions. I'll kind of combine them into one. I think people are just kind of more wanting to learn a little bit more about your device. Tim asked, how do you place a flexible lead in the brain? Where does the lead need to be placed to be effective? And someone else asked, how exactly is the GBM treated with the implants? What the exact mechanism? So just if you want, maybe just kind of dive a little bit deeper for those who are wanting to learn more.
Yeah, sure. So, in terms of how we implant the device into a human brain, we've been doing this with our surgeon in cadaveric models. So right now we're using a stylet-style needle, very small needle. We have an exposed area at the end of the device that latches onto this area of the needle. We're currently adapting a VarioGuide from Brainlabs to actually guide that into the brain. That seems to be fine for now. There will need to be a lot of more planning that goes into that in the future. So that's how we get it in. In terms of the location, we've looked, I would say, more in the rodent models. We've looked at both surface-based recording, so recording from the cortex of the brain versus recording intraparenchymally. And we're trying to understand at the moment, right now we see recordings in both. So we're trying to figure out as we start to look towards therapeutic, which is actually providing an electrical input to try and stop or target those cells. We're trying to understand whether we can do that from the surface or from the depth. Our current knowledge is suggesting that we need to be closer to it, so closer as close as we can to the mass of the tumor. A lot of these tumors are diffuse, so we've also been looking at multi-lead strategies to combat locations. They don't kind of grow as a mass as everyone would expect. They kind of spread quite diffusely. I think there was a question about mechanism of action or something like this. So in terms of the mechanism that we're trying to target, we're essentially looking at how the neurons actually essentially signal into to the cancer cells. These are seen by the cancer cells as growth signals. And so we're trying to essentially use electrical stimulation to suppress the activity in that environment to stop those signaling going into those tumors. That's as much as I can probably say right now.
We've got about 10 minutes left and the questions are continuing to come in, but feel free to throw in any last minute questions here. We'll try to get to them as we can. Rolf just asked, we said thank you both for sharing about your journeys. I'm curious what stages of commercialization and go-to market Opto and ResonantLink are in. If either of you are able to share much on that or wanted to touch on that part, I'll leave it open to whoever wants to take that.
Yeah, and hi, Rolf, but Elise should definitely take that. Yes.
So we're so super early stage. We're in like non-GLP safety study. So before you go through the stages for an FDA submission or anything like that, we're really trying to validate that the device concept itself is safe. Once we've shown that that's safe, then we would go through that sort of quality regulated system to make sure that, and then repeat these studies, these safety studies, and use that as a submission for the FDA if the FDA was the market that we were going for first. So we're a pre-seed company. We're about a year old, so super early stage and still figuring it out.
We've got a question about talent and workforce, which is continuing to be a big topic of discussion for, I think, everyone in the healthcare and medical field. I said, as executives within your respective companies, how do you work to bring on the best talent and further create a culture that retains and promotes current employees?
Yeah, it's a constant challenge, right? The most important thing. So love the question. I think for us, really, it's about the mission, and that's why almost everyone at ResonantLink is here. Working at a startup is a unique challenge, and like that attachment to the mission is, I think, what's shared across the team. And then for us, really, what we're trying to do is attract the very best people in power, in wireless power specifically, so that our partners don't need to worry about recruiting at least one group of very hard to find talent there.
Yeah, I think to add to that, what we've really tried to do with our recruitment at Opto is really diversify the talent because, we came from a lab with some of the best, people in bioelectronics, implantable bioelectronics from a research perspective, in the world. And it was hard to not want to pull a lot of people who are leaving the lab, going out to get postdocs or jobs. It was hard not to try and bring everyone in, right? Because it makes sense. They're right there. They're already here. But one of the things that we've really tried to focus on is really diversifying the experience in the team. Again, I think I mentioned it earlier, but taking people from like the automotive industry, sort of the robotics industry, really trying to get different perspective because this is how you kind of create those out of box ideas that, or like out of the box solutions to some of the really challenging engineering challenges that we're going to face. At the same time, making sure that you have that really key medical device translation expertise and regulatory expertise. It's definitely a challenge to try and find the right people, but mission driven, I think, is like, well, maybe a vibe check is really quite important for us as well.
Another question that just came in from Mark. He asks, how do you approach vendors who may have concerns about use of their materials or components in vivo, especially in chronic applications? For whichever you wants to take that one first.
Yeah, that's a really good one, and one that I didn't, when you start these, you don't really think about these problems about like, a lot of materials that you're using in the in vivo setting are fine to use in those settings, but when you're talking about putting devices in humans, you really have to think about every single material that you're putting in, where it's coming from, what the supply chain is, what the impact of, like a global pandemic might be on your supply chain to be able to make these medical devices. So I think having basically how it's been having people who have experience with vendors already has been really, really instrumental for us. So bringing in that expertise, and then using their network to sort of expand, going to lots of conferences, meeting different vendors in that way. And then, of course, trying to source and use materials that we know are already safe, biocompatible, and are regulated in the industry is the goal as much as possible, right?
Lisa, one more kind of technical one that had been asked earlier, and I haven't asked yet. But in a person's cancer journey, where does your product come in, pre or post chemo, and how do you coordinate with oncologists?
I think we kind of already had a similar question to this, but at the moment we see it within the current standard of care that we would implant the device during a standard surgical resection, whether it was pre or post chemotherapy. In the case of glioblastoma, most of them fail anyway. So I think we're still trying to understand where we would be able to have the most impact for those patients. What we're seeing now at the advice that we're getting at the moment from our oncologists and like the oncologists that we speak to is pre-radiotherapy is where they're thinking about this. But I mean, we'll see as we go through the journey.
Maybe one more question here from the audience, and we'll have some closing remarks here. But someone asked, how did you find and make decision to collaborate with key opinion leaders? What was the important factors to be considered for future successful growth?
Yeah, I think we work with physicians. We work with partners like Elise and her team, and I think we are looking to work with more patients that, live with the devices that we're helping make rechargeable or make better or bring to market. And so I think Elise probably has a better perspective on those key opinion leaders. We're kind of one step removed and working with our partners, in a lot of those contexts.
I think for us, especially with the key opinion leaders, is dependent on your relationship with them and how long you've had that relationship with them, and sort of what their stronghold beliefs are in terms of a treatment modality or a treatment paradigm or the standard of care. So with a lot of the, I guess, the advisors that we have on board, before they're actually formalized as an advisor or, a key opinion leader for us, we really spend a lot of time working with them. You kind of have to balance the like, what are the incentives or what would this opinion actually mean for you as a company? And how strongly do you believe that opinion? And like, are you going to go, are you going to go out and say that this is exactly what you're trying to do or this is what you strongly believe as well? I think you really need to find the people who are going to be like the strong arm for you and the company and the technology. And that takes some time and definitely takes a lot of relationship building with the right people.
Great. Well, thank you to everybody who sent in their questions. If we didn't get to you, we apologize for that. We're almost up on time here, but appreciate the interaction here from the audience. And for both Elise and Grayson, I'll give you each about a minute or so to just any kind of final thoughts if you wanted to leave our audience with anything before we sign off for the day. So Elise, we'll start with you, and then we'll let Grayson close it.
I definitely feel like I've spoken a lot on this call. And I think I'm just really grateful for everyone who's come in. I spent the hour to listen in. So thank you for that. If you have any questions or you want to talk more, feel free to reach out. And yeah, I hope that if you are trying to innovate something that you go for it. That would be great.
Yeah, Tyler, thanks so much for having us. I think from our end, we're always looking for great partners with amazing product visions that we can help them bring their devices to market. And we're super grateful to get to work with Elise and the Opto team to make that happen for their amazing product vision. And the highlight for me was getting to learn more about that from Elise today. So thanks so much, Tyler. Thanks to the audience, and looking forward to seeing people next time.
Awesome. And thanks to both Elise Jenkins and Grayson Zuloff. And thanks to ResonantLink for making today's webinar possible. Thanks to everybody for tuning in today. I hope you all have a great day.